And welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I am Brian Keller.
And I'm Habib Hayarian.
Habib, you've been on the show once before? Twice before?
Once before.
Once before.
It's great to be back, Brian.
It is so great to have you back. You kind of left the developer division. You're the guy behind like IntelliTrace, or one of the guys behind IntelliTrace, and a lot of the debugging support in Visual Studio. And then you kind of went off and did this Secret Squirrel project for a while, and you wouldn't even tell me what you were working on, but we knew it was something related to robotics. And rather than actually dive into that now, let's just tell people to wait till the end, and maybe we'll have some more stuff to talk about on that front.
Yeah, that sounds great, Brian. So, you know, after essentially 10 and a half years in Visual Studio, because of my passion for robotics, I decided to try something different, and it's been an amazing ride, so I cannot wait to share with you guys.
That's
what
awesome.
We've got in store.
That's awesome. It's been killing you having to keep these secrets for a long, long
time,
but you did a good job. Yeah. So somewhat related to what you're working on, this week is the Kinect's first birthday party.
I got to tell you, Brian, when it comes to robotics and the robotics developer community, I don't think nothing has even come close to the disruption that Kinect has caused. I mean, we have seen a tremendous amount of uptake in the robotics developer community when it comes to Kinect. And obviously, there are now hundreds, if not thousands, of hacks out there.
So
it's just unbelievable.
So. Yeah, definitely. Now, what is it from your perspective that makes the Kinect different? Is it the fact that it's this mass market consumer device and I can go buy one for a couple hundred dollars? Mm-hmm. Or is it the fact that there truly is some new software and hardware that's in there that you just didn't have access to before?
I'd say it's really kind of both. If you think of the robotics community right now, just to put together a robot could be thousands and thousands of thousands of dollars. So now you have this device that has a 4-channel microwave, has a depth sensor, it has an RGB camera, all this bundled into this sub $200 product. Not to mention that it's completely portable. You can plug into your PC and start writing apps with the Kinect for Windows SDK. I think nothing so far that I've seen comes close to this package set of goodies in one single product. So, and as far as robotics is concerned, I think people are just doing some amazing stuff, including experimenting with SLAM algorithms and vision and so forth like that. I am so excited about what's going on with Kinect right now. I can't.
So of course I know all about SLAM algorithms, but for those folks that don't know about SLAM, what is a SLAM algorithm?
So the idea is if you want to, when you're writing your robotics application and specifically a mobile robot, if you want to know where the robot is at any one time, so it's all about essentially autonomous navigation, right?
Got it.
How do you know where you are? How do you know where you're going and so forth? So using SLAM, you can now figure out where the robot is at any one time within a certain environment and also where it needs to go.
What does that stand for?
Stands for simultaneous localization, and I forgot what the M stands.
That's what the internet's
but
for.
But that's, yes.
Got it. That's awesome. I could talk about that all day,
okay.
But we do have some more news to get to here. So this is the Microsoft Media Platform, and I think we may have talked about this years ago. They've got a framework that makes it really easy for you to embed a Silverlight video player, whether that's on the desktop or on the phone, for example, and then take advantage of Silverlight streaming. And so they just updated that. And so one example where they've used this, of course, is with the NBC Olympics from a couple years ago, where they had all the events streaming live, and you could rewind and go back and forth, and then that became on-demand available. So they've basically taken that, and they've open-sourced it, and they made it available for folks to be able to take advantage of.
Great. And does that work with, I believe it's called IIS Smooth Streaming?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Okay. Yes, that's right.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and so if you're looking to enable that type of solution, really cool, and you can do it on Mango now. They just released support for Mango.
Great.
And then they also are starting to move everything under this collective player framework, which also includes an HTML5 version of basically the same thing. So you can expect that this page is going to evolve to start to capture that.
Okay.
So introduction to HTML5 for ASP.NET developers. I think this is really nice to see, because obviously if you're kind of a born on the web ASP.NET developer, it can be a little bit tricky to understand exactly what HTML5 can offer you. And I think there's a lot of great stuff coming. Obviously, the canvas tag, some of the other capabilities like the video tag being built right in. That's super cool. One I didn't know about is the offline support.
Okay.
So the ability for you to actually have offline storage. I think previously you were limited to, I can't remember how many kilobytes, but now you actually get 5 megs of offline storage that your website can take advantage of on the user's desktop.
Got it. So is the idea then, Brian, that if I'm a Visual Studio developer today, right, I get these extensions for HTML5 and I can then write applications that are web-based apps, but I can write offline applications now, right? So for example, if I disconnect from a network, for example, then mm-hmm. my application continues to work, and then when I go back online, the synchronization and data happens.
That's absolutely one of the scenarios you can enable, and that actually brings us into what's called donut hole caching. I believe that Scott Guthrie coined this term, but donut hole caching says, hey, let me cache some of this stuff, but also maybe give the user a different experience when I'm offline.
Yeah, I believe the whole idea behind donut whole caching is the fact that, you know, as far as your main web app is concerned or web page is concerned, that's pretty much can stay as is. Then you can have little islands of data that can be updated as you wish, essentially. Mm-hmm. So rather than having to refresh the entire page, you can have small pockets of kind of data that update on parts of the page itself. So
right.
I think that lends itself to a really smooth user experience when it comes to a person browsing a web app.
Sure, definitely. And the example, one of the examples that they talk about here for donut hole caching mm-hmm. is you've got a website maybe for your donut shop,
right.
And you go offline with that website and you've got it cached. Well, instead of giving somebody like an email address, which is useless if you're offline, or a website, another link they could click to, actually present the user with a phone number. So
right.
you can actually present these completely different experiences there.
That's really cool.
But I can imagine a lot of other, you know, nice scenarios that start to come alive with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of HTML5, this is a presentation that came out, what's the name of the conference? Strange Loop 2011.
Right.
And it's really a focus on some of the amazing things that you can do with HTML5 Canvas that really open up a lot of possibilities for rich in-browser applications.
Okay. So is the idea then, essentially, I can use the canvas element that comes with HTML5 and be able to kind of do interesting things with HTML5 and so forth? Is that
That's definitely the idea. And really, if you think about the role of a runtime like Flash or even Silverlight, I think a lot of those are starting to what you may have been required to use Flash or Silverlight for in the past is now becoming more and more possible with a runtime like HTML5. So video, absolutely, or Canvas, the ability for you to even do things like perspective 3D become possible once you start taking advantage of that.
Okay, so. That's awesome. I think basically being able to develop these rich applications that if today you're using, let's say, WPF or mm-hmm. Silverlight, you can just continue the same experience now with HTML5.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. Okay. Yep. So so speaking of being able to take advantage of HTML5, we have a very HTML5 stacked episode so far. I promise we're going to diverge. But Mads Christensen actually has been talking a lot on his blog about the different ways that as a Visual Studio 2010 developer, you can start kind of dipping your toes in the HTML5 waters, both in terms of guidance and things that you can add to Visual Studio 2010 to get you additional functionality like the IntelliSense support. And this is the Web Essentials, which is an extension for Visual Studio 2010. And it's got some really nice things in here, not just for HTML5 development support, but just in general for web developers. So you may have seen the demo of the, I don't know what they're calling this, but like a color picker for IntelliSense, where instead of saying, color dot red or color dot blue, you actually get a little spin wheel that comes up and allows you to pick the color. The other thing I really like is the ability to Base64 encode,
right.
Like a PNG.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great that you can do that right within your resource, but then the problem is that you've then got 64K of information that's stacked within your text editor. Well, this allows you to then trim that down, kind of like a region?
Right,
within
right.
Visual Studio,
yep.
So get that out of my way.
Yeah. I love the fact that, they're exploring ideas around IntelliSense that are beyond just method names mm-hmm. and property names. The fact that you now get IntelliSense for color, I think.
Yeah.
That's a way, way cool idea. So
yeah.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really great story. It was written actually by our own Duncan McKenzie, who is his team is the team behind keeping Channel 9 and other similar properties up and running. And he wrote a white paper where he basically talks about what a great experience it's been moving Channel 9 over to the Windows Azure platform.
Okay. And one of the I actually have a friend right now who's doing a startup right now with Windows Azure. And he was describing to me his experience around development and the fact that we're putting out these essentially frameworks or extensions that allow people to develop on Azure. He was telling me has made essentially moving to the cloud for him that much easier. So I think there's another section that we might talk about, you know, those these extensions for Azure, but
the toolkit.
Exactly. So I love the fact that, you know, writing against the cloud is now getting just as easy as writing against like the client or any other application that you can do today.
Right? Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm sure they could use your help with is debugging cloud applications.
Right.
I think that's one of the harder things right now is just being able to get all that information back. You can't necessarily attach a debugger like you would have had to in the past.
Right.
But I expect that they'll sort that out within, you know, not too much longer. And I really like what Duncan says here. He says, imagine if you're an architect, like a building architect, and you were responsible for also being the janitor in all the buildings that you put up. That's kind of the burden we put on people that are application architects, or at least those teams are kind of also responsible in a lot of cases for maintaining the servers and patching them and everything else. Now with Windows Azure, you don't even care where those servers are located. You can just, you know, party on the code and do what you do best.
Yeah. And speaking of Azure, one of the ideas that it's really now booming in robotics is the idea of cloud robotics, where essentially now you can use the cloud as the communication mechanism, not just between a robot and the cloud, but many robots and the cloud. So you now can build this intelligence and storage in the cloud and have a, you know, 24/7 connected robot that just talks to the cloud to kind of as part of its brain, so to speak. So I'm particularly super jazzed about Azure because we're going to do lots of interesting things.
So let me get your prediction right here for all of our both of our listeners out there. How long before Judgment Day and the robots start fighting back?
Well, I can't tell you the exact date, Brian, but I got to tell you, you know, I was telling this to my wife the other day. If I was a student at a college or university right now, I think by far the most exciting field to get into is robotics. I mean, when you think about the challenges in technology today, right? Things like speech reco, you know, natural language processing, AI, and so forth.
Autonomous vehicles, yeah.
It's the mecca of the most fun and exciting things that is out there. So I can't tell you, but I'm hoping that more and more people would get in the field to make my vision of, you know, essentially actually Bill G's vision of a robot in every single home possible one day. So I don't know the exact date. It might happen.
All right. So let's find another show topic that we can somehow bring back into robots. Let's see. Windows Azure, Windows 8, and some deployment tips. So this is a toolkit that makes it easier for you to build Windows 8 Metro-style applications that then, in turn, talk to the cloud. Does Windows 8 offer anything compelling for robotics developers?
It's actually quite interesting because if you look at the Metro UI on Windows 8 right now, and in conjunction with for example, Kinect, that could be a really nice kind of input mode when you think about it, right? So we don't know yet. We're experimenting with a bunch of ideas and various user models right now. But right now we're just thinking, you know, robotics is going to happen. It's going to be a really interesting field, and everything with Nui and Kinect and the Metro, there could be just a whole exciting slew of things happening in the future.
Nice. So getting back to this particular topic, this is the Windows Azure Toolkit for Windows 8, which, again, if you're building those Metro-style applications, you know, thinking about where you're going to store your data and being able to take advantage of things like notifications on your start page, that's a great use for the cloud. Mm-hmm. And especially as you think about, you know, I've got my tablet PC and I'm going to roam from location to location, and maybe I'm a traveling salesman, or maybe I just am a student, I'm, you know, in the classroom or going home or whatever, I want to be able to access my data anytime, regardless of what channel it's coming through. And so this makes it really nice to do those occasionally connected scenarios and then just filter your data back down when you need it and set up those workflows to run in the cloud or whatever. Yeah. So it's really nice to see that this toolkit, like you said, really can help accelerate those types of scenarios. So this is really cool for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's an icon pack for people that are doing Windows Phone development. I like they've even got an Android icon over here. This is not just for Windows Phone. But what's really cool about this is the guy behind this Templarian. His name is Andrew. I forgot his last name. Sorry, Andrew. We'll have you in the show notes. But he actually is so invested in creating these cool icons that you can tweet and mention Templarian, and then in a few hours later, if you tweet like, "Hey, I need an icon of my friend Habib here,"
right.
A few hours later, he would come back with an icon of you in your full 16x16 glory. So
I think that's a really neat idea, and the fact that you know it's basically licensed under the Creative Commons, it means that you know anyone can basically use it in their applications.
So. Yeah, so I applaud that effort.
Yeah,
nice job, Andrew.
Yeah.
So this one's really cool. We were talking about this earlier. So using your phone as a remote control, but actually I first thought, okay, this is yet another, you know, phone as remote control for Media Center. But it's actually a much broader release than this. So this guy, Mr. Good Cat, I'm sure that's not his real name, he put together this phone as a remote control library, and he's got an awesome video that shows you how you can use his phone set of APIs to actually remote control any application type, whether that's a media center or it could just be, you know, a WPF application or maybe a home automation or a robot that's running a home or something like that. And it's a really great video. He's even got some cool gestures, like if you wanted to move the mouse, you can just have this touch screen and move the mouse with one finger.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you wanted if you had a browser up on your screen and you wanted to move the whole browser, you can use two fingers and move those in parallel, and that would be a scroll mechanism.
Yeah, I am really excited about this. In fact, you know, we're talking about this before, but if you haven't seen the Xbox Companion yet, I think it's a really, really kind of good way to think about the applications that will be enabled. Brian was talking about this, you know, as you're watching a movie, essentially, now you can find out, you know, information about the characters in the movie and the other movies that they played and so forth.
Yeah, so this is going to be coming soon.
Right.
As part of the fall update with the Xbox 360.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea then is that I can use my phone to, say, maybe find a movie that I'm interested in and then tell my Xbox to play it. My Xbox starts streaming the movie and playing it.
Right.
And meanwhile, on my phone, I can bring up a list of all the actors, and, you know, I'm terrible at actors. I don't know about you, but I can't tell the difference between Brad Pitt and Matt Damon sometimes. It's really, really bad. But in any event, I think this is an exciting space.
Yeah, I think this is one of the areas where, again, you've now opened up all these possibilities, and you just let, you know, developers loose to build all these killer applications.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So this is part of our weekly Build flashback story.
Mm-hmm.
So we know there was a ton of content that happened at Build, so we're kind of going back and picking our recommendations of the best of the best. And this week's recommendation is Jason Zander's What's New in Visual Studio 11 talk.
Cool.
So did you used to work for Jason Zander?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I got to say, he's amazing at both, you know, wide business level kind of decision making, as well as, you know, understanding what's going on at the high level.
Yep.
But good Lord, since he was a, you know, developer before, he also understands all the way down to the API level.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's scary smart.
So huge respect for the guy, and he's a really good speaker as well.
Yeah,
so I would highly recommend people.
Great
to
presenter. He likes to do his own demos and that sort of thing. So this talk gives you a kind of an end to end look at what's coming out in Visual Studio 11. Some of which we've talked about on the show before, but there's a lot of things in there that Jason likes to show off that I learn something new every time I watch one of his talks.
Okay.
So it's really cool.
Great.
Let's see. So Channel 9 highlight .NET 4.5 conversation with the BCL team. So you know a few of these guys, right?
Yeah. In fact, the guy right in the middle of your screen, you know, Brian Grunkenmeier, I joined Microsoft straight out of school in 2000. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that I worked on is the C++ team, essentially. Mm. And back then, we were working on things like Managed C++ and so forth. And I knew Brian Grunkenmeier way back from there because he was working on essentially .NET Framework 1.0. So it's just an amazing thing to see. You know, he's still with the BCL team and still as passionate about APIs and making the .NET Framework as productive as possible and essentially bringing it into the whole, you know, new multi-threaded asynchronous world. So it's exciting to see. He knows his space. I think, better than anyone else that I know of.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what a great team he's got working for him. So I would encourage you to check out Charles's video. Use headphones. I was having a hard time listening to it on my laptop. I gave Charles some flack for that. He's fixing it. but great video nonetheless of a lot of the things that, again, you may not have heard of, but it's just more and more goodness that's coming to done at 4.5.
Right.
So what was your first job then on that team?
So my first job was I was working as the program manager for the C++ project system. So, you know when you say Control-Shift-B to build your project, I was the PM who would basically make sure all your project properties are set properly, that they have, you know, all those kind of like things that make your build work.
Yeah.
And then from then on, I moved to things like the new project dialogue and, you know, big exciting things like new item dialogue and then onto the debugger.
Yeah, exactly. That's from here to like there. Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great career. So speaking of Visual Studio and projects, this is a good segue into another thing that you may not be familiar with, which is the side-by-side, or not side-by-side, they're calling it round-tripping of projects. So do you want to talk about this one?
Yeah, this is actually a really, even though it might seem mundane, this is a massive, massive improvement in my mind. So I would go out to the field, talk to customers, or we would bring them in and we'd talk about what are your major pain points with Visual Studio. And one of the biggest pain points was, as customers would move on to the next version of Visual Studio, they would have to upgrade their project, but they could no longer open up those projects in the current version of Visual Studio, which would be a massive, actually, barrier to adoption, right?
Yep.
I think it's a huge step forward where now you can, you know, take your Visual Studio 2010 SP1 project, open it up in Visual Studio 11, and then open up the exact same project again in Visual Studio 2010 SP1.
Absolutely.
That is a huge, huge win. So, It might sound a bit geeky, but I got to tell you, this is a massive thing for being able to kind of stay productive and work in a team environment.
Oh, I hear about it all the time. And then the other thing that's really nice about this too is, let's say you've got a couple of people on your team that just want to go kick the tires with the new betas before your corporation has approved everyone on the team to go use the next version of VS.
Right.
This is a good way to do that. So I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
So kudos to the team for
huge,
making that happen.
Huge deal.
And then obviously, of course, the other thing that they did in VS 2010 is allowed you to target multiple versions of the .NET framework.
Right.
By side, so it all goes hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can then have target multiple versions of the runtime as well as be able to open up the same project in multiple versions of Visual Studio, which is, again, that's a huge
killer.
One,
yeah. So this is really fun. So speaking of debugging, actually, this episode's really kind of tailored around your interests. So we had summer interns, as we always do, and this is a video that Charles did interviewing three of those interns talking about parallel watch visualizers. So these are debugging. Well, this is your baby.
Yeah. So one of the things that we created in Visual Studio 2005, I believe, is this idea of what you want to do as a developer is you want to be able to visualize data in its natural state.
Right.
So an example is if you have an array of data that's really a data point in a graph, for example.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be nice if you could essentially see that 2D graph, right? So we invented this framework for debugger visualizers, and tons of developers create these visualizers. One of the interesting things that's happened over the years, Brian, you know, we started with things like single core, then we moved to multi-core, and very soon we're going to get into many core. What that means is that you're going to have potentially thousands of threads now running on many, many cores.
Right.
And imagine trying to debug, for example, a data race.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
I mean, that's going to be pretty much impossible, right? So what you have now is through these parallel watch window visualizers is you can now debug your data that's basically being accessed by, you know, potentially thousands of threads. And I'm really excited about this because without a tool like this, it kind of makes your debugging a printf experience. I mean, you really have to go back and, you know, open up your editor and then put a bunch of printf statements and to be able to debug it. So this is huge. And the reason why I'm more excited about it is that you now have a bunch of essentially interns doing this work, which I think if I was an intern, I would get a, you know, massive kick out of doing something like this.
Oh, heck yeah. And I think, you know, with all due respect to the interns, it shows how easy the debugging visualizers
are
to write.
Yeah.
These aren't people that have just been on the Visual Studio team for 10 years like you. These are people that are new to the tools, stepping in and just making it happen all within 12 weeks from cradle to grave. So I think that's really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So Prism. So Prism is I guess you'd call it guidance or a set of patterns and practices that the patterns and practices team has come out with that helps you build Silverlight and WPF composite applications.
Okay.
And if you're building Silverlight and WPF applications, but you're kind of heard of this Prism thing, maybe you're not sure, whether or not it's for you, that's what this Getting Started series is for by Brian Noyes.
So this would be perfect for me, since I have no idea what Prism is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of those things that I've kind of looked at in the past and kind of been overwhelmed with.
Okay.
But I think composite applications are really the way I would imagine most enterprise applications are going to be built, where you have individual components that are being version controlled in different, like a CRM application.
Right.
You might
okay.
have different pages, different areas of the application that are on their own evolution, separate from the others. So how do you build those in a way that they have the right contracts in place to be able to talk to other aspects of the application, that sort of thing. So if that sounds like a problem space that you're in, the Patterns and Practices team does a lot of work to build and maintain this guidance.
Great. So thank you, Brian Noyce, I guess, for putting this out.
Absolutely. Okay. He does lots of cool stuff. So Metro Style for IL Spy. This is really cool.
It is. Yeah. I was kind of half joking with Brian a few minutes ago, talking about, we're now bringing decompilation into the 21st century, if you think about it.
I like what you said. It's the evolution of decomposition.
So it's interesting. I think it was my second month when I joined the C++ team, a bunch of people were showing me how to use ILDASM to essentially decompile managed C++ code to make sure that it's all kosher and everything else. So to see that, something like ILDASM evolve, 10, 12 years later into something like ILSpy, it's actually, I get a massive kick out of it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going from, you have this command line UI that you grok a bunch of text, essentially. Now you have this beautiful, UI that you can, got this, it's way sexier.
Oh, yeah, nice. Definitely. And what the Metro style is actually this guy, Joseph, who downloaded ILSpy, and he cracked the source and started basically putting his own UI on the front of it. And he basically modeled it after the Metro style interface for a phone and, Windows 8. And I think it's really cool to see something that is a very highly technical application like that actually embrace something like Metro style. Because you never would have really put the two together. I wouldn't have.
Certainly wouldn't have been.
Yeah, but it works. Looking at the menu and everything. So first stable build of Node.js on Windows release. So Node.js, is this something you've heard of?
Yeah, I've actually heard a bunch of stuff about Node.js. And the way I understand it, so just to be perfectly transparent, I've never actually used it myself, but the way I understand it is if you want to essentially build scalable web servers or web farms, the idea is that, Node.js is the perfect thing to do it. And I think you had an example of, how essentially you can use something like this to build. Do you know what that was, Brian?
What was that?
That was essentially our robot saying, "What's up?" So I'll get to that in a second. But coming back to the discussion.
He's getting lonely over there.
Before is essentially if you want to build scalable web farms or web servers, that's Node.js for you. So
let's be clear. ASP.NET, okay. Microsoft has a lot of technologies for doing scalable web farms, lots of people doing that. But Node.js has kind of captured an area of the market where people are building scalable web farms basically using JavaScript, which is kind of crazy on the back end, but it's working for people. And now this is the DPE interoperability team here at Microsoft working with the Node.js developers to make sure that everything they're doing actually runs on Windows as well. So
great.
So
okay.
If you're doing Node.js development and you were not quite using Windows as your platform, now you can.
Okay.
Yep. So that's cool. Now, finally, I think our last story before the pick of the week here is Beth Massey, friend of the show. Love Beth. She writes an article here about how you can use LightSwitch, and I didn't know this. Obviously, you can connect to a SQL Express database, but you can diagram your SQL Express tables as well, which is something I didn't know was supported in LightSwitch.
Yeah, I mean, I've been using Visual Studio for 10-plus years now, and I've been using Data Explorer and so forth for a long time, but I had no idea that LightSwitch actually supported something like that.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, it's a really, this is one of those productivity tools where it just makes kind of design and of schema and so forth that much easier in my mind.
And it makes sense when you think about kind of the developer that they are targeting, somebody who may have a lot of experience with access backgrounds that sort of thing. Obviously, being able to build your tables and maintain those is important. So that brings us to picks of the week, which, Habib, I got to say, your pick of the week slide is empty here.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the little beep that you heard a couple of minutes ago, you know, a thing saying what's up, is actually our robot that we've been working on for a while now. And what I'll do instead of, you know, I was thinking instead of showing you a slide, I'll actually
bring it on.
Here. So
let's do it.
I'm going to take, excuse me for a second, what I will take. So the thing that I'm going to bring here is the famous Roborazzi.
Yes.
What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to stand right here.
So we talked about this last week a little bit.
Yes.
We can see the screen there.
Can you see the screen there?
Yep. Okay. What's up?
Say cheese.
So...
That's awesome.
I just took a picture of me without me doing anything to it. And in fact, there is my picture right there on the screen.
Say cheese.
So what it's doing, I don't know if your audio is picking up, but what it's doing is it's looking for your skeleton, right? Maybe you should come back and mic up here.
I will actually come back right here.
Say cheese.
I love that. And we, obviously we don't have the real estate here, but it would move around if we wanted to. I see you've got an Xbox controller, so you can manually move it around. So those things are all possible. So tell me a little bit more about how this was conceived and built and put together.
Sure. So, Brian, you probably know that Robotics Developer Studio has been around for at least, you know, 4 or 5 years now. And we've had a pretty good uptake on that from both hobbyists and academics and so forth. But what we really wanted to do is explore what kind of applications could you build using Robotic Developer Studio. And so what we did was we partnered with a company called Parallax, which is quite well known in the robotics community. They essentially build really cool hardware that you can, and as well as some software as well that you can use to build various types of robots and applications. And we said, let's build essentially a platform or a kit so that we can explore some applications. And the main components of this platform are essentially, you know, you have the wheels and you have the motors.
You call this a platform?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We call that a platform where it's a mobile platform and it has a bunch of sensors like IR sensors and so forth and has a controller board. And the way the essentially the CPU is powered by a laptop essentially. So this could be any laptop that you have lying around, and all you have to do is, you know, have Windows 7 and Robotic Developer Studio 4 beta, which we released just a few months ago at the Make Your Fair.
That's right.
Yep, we were there with our little robot here called Roborazzi, and it just can essentially, you know, extend it with any peripheral that you like. So what we've got right here is I've got my Xbox controller, and this is just nothing except, you know, the Xbox controller for Windows, and you can see a little USB device back. You can't see it on the camera, but it's back right here.
Yep.
And on top, what we've got is essentially a Canon SLR that we've plugged in. And it's really cool. We went out to the web, downloaded the Canon SDK, and we wrote an application. So what the way it works is using the Kinect sensor up here, it uses skeletal tracking to detect that there is a person there, essentially. And then it approaches that person and then says, you know, say cheese, and then takes a photo of the person. And we've actually already had people approach us saying, you know what, this would be an amazing thing at my wedding or at my birthday, right? So you now take away the kind of cumbersome task of going around and taking photos. And in fact, people want to be approached by the by Roborazzi and be able to take the pictures taken.
And and it automatically uploads them to Flickr, which could be a good or a bad thing depending on how crazy your party gets.
Exactly. We've had a ton of learning through this platform with Robotic Developer Studio and Kinect and so forth, and we're really excited to kind of continue building further applications. But at the same time, you know, if you're a developer out there who's really excited about writing robotics applications, the platform that you see right here, this is one of the early prototypes, so it looks a little bit different. But you basically have the two kind of trays where you can extend it and put additional things on it. It's actually available from Parallax.
Okay.
Where you can go and purchase it, and it's for it's $1,249 if you want to buy the entire kit without the laptop.
Minus the laptop and the camera. Okay.
Camera, exactly.
But everything else I see here, I
can everything else that you can put together. And what we've done actually to kickstart this project is we have a competition called Robotics at Home.
Okay.
And if you go to roboticsathome.com, where the idea is you can submit an idea to Microsoft, and you know, we're going to essentially judge the various ideas. And if we think it's a cool idea, we're going to ask you to build that idea on top of essentially an Eddie platform, and we'll give you $10,000 for it.
So, oh, wow.
We've actually been, you know, on the team thinking, gosh, I wish we could enter it.
Yeah, you're not eligible, right? Yeah.
Microsoft employees aren't eligible, unfortunately, but
I'll quit.
So
that's cool.
If you like robotics,
yeah.
I mean, it's one of the best ways to get in it right now. And like I said, every single one of these components is off the shelf. I mean,
right.
There's just nothing, you know, very specific out there.
So talk to me a little bit more about the software, right?
Okay.
So I can imagine, you know, like you said, these are all off the shelf. You're
right.
Telling me about the camera has an SDK available.
Right.
I can imagine going out and like putting together a WPF application and a simple loop and all those sorts of things to kind of build something similar to this. What is it that Robotics Developer Studio actually brings to the equation that makes this easier?
So RDS, Robotics Developer Studio, provides three core things. There is essentially the runtime, which is made of CCR, which is Coordination and Concurrency Runtime.
Okay.
The idea is robots are typically made up of various sensors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so inherently it's an
event-driven...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what you don't want to be doing is that as you're trying to process essentially data from your cliff sensors,
mm-hmm.
right, suddenly you stop and then try and process data from your other sensors. And
meanwhile your robot tips
exactly,
over.
Exactly,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
we provide that entire runtime. So we take all of the care of all the plumbing for you, essentially.
Right.
So that's one component of RDS. The other component is the simulation environment, right? So one of the things you hopefully don't want to do is as you're kind of experimenting with algorithms, right? And especially if they're around navigation, you don't want to bump into the walls too many times, hopefully.
Sure.
So you want to kind of simulate what you're trying to do in this rich environment. So what we have is this very rich GUI environment where you can literally, you know, let's say use your Xbox controller and drive your robot around in the environment that you have designed, right? So it's a very compelling way to kind of test out your scenarios before deploying it to a real environment.
Okay.
And the third component is this thing called VPL, Virtual Programming Language, right? So if you are a person who's kind of like just getting into robotics and you don't want to get into details of actually writing code, you can kind of use this drag and drop various components on this design surface where you can drag like a logic gate or you can drag some kind of additional, you know, sensors and so forth on that,
on that,
kind of hook that all up and then kind of let it run, right, and see what it looks like.
And then do I have the option of taking that VPL and turning that into C# code?
Exactly. So it's essentially, you know, it's a really nice ramp up, you know, from I don't know much about robotics, but I want to experiment with some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Then I want to experiment with some ideas in the simulation environment, right? And then it's like, okay, understand the concepts of robotics, understand how sensors and actuators work. Now I'm ready to actually deploy it onto a real robot. So an instance of a real robot is, of course, Eddie right here. But since RDS is agnostic, as long as you have a Windows environment, you can run on any robot that you'd like. So it's a model where we've said, you know what, we have this really rich platform and runtime and tools and SDK. You can take that and apply it to any hardware platform that you like. So
that's great.
I cannot wait to hear both ideas, you know, from various developers on this, and also just to experiment some more around Eddie and the application.
And what was the website one more time?
So it's roboticsathome.com.
Got it. Okay. That's very, very cool. Well, I actually deferred my pick of the week to you, so we'd have the most time to talk about this. And I think that just about does it. So, Habib, once again, always a pleasure to have you here. I'm so excited to see what you come up with next.
Thank you very much, Brian. As usual, it's been an awesome thing to be on the show, and I can't wait, hopefully, to come back again, maybe in the future, with a bunch of more applications.
And my birthday is in 2 weeks, and I expect this to be
okay, great,
so
yes.
We'll see you next week.
Just send me your address, and we'll take care of it.